Hey, friendly reminder, this podcast is not for kids or people who have a stick up their ass.
Friday, 5:58 p.m.
I'm sleeping with my best friend's husband.
I think my uncle killed someone in his suicide.
I am a sugar baby.
I'm a soccer mom addicted to Adderall.
I think my sister is actually my uncle's kid.
My husband bought his hooker a car whenever
I was helping his mom. I was a
What's your secret? Welcome back to another week of Beyond the Secret. My name is Ace Fanning, and I have a crazy story for you today. But before we get into that, I have a very bittersweet announcement to make. And I really hope you don't skip through the intro today. I don't know if people do that or not. I probably would, just to avoid hearing my own voice. But I just ask that today you make an exception. So I started Beyond the Secret 4 years ago, and I had no intentions of starting a podcast. It just happened by chance, and I had no clue what I was doing. And I still cringe listening to old episodes, but I'm also really appreciative of them because they show me how much growth I've had over the course of these 4 years. And I don't mean like in creating a podcast, like as a human being. I believe that this show has completely changed the person I am for the better. And it's no secret that I struggle with my depression and my overall mental health. And for 4 years, Beyond the Secret has truly helped me better understand myself and those struggles. And I will also say that it has also really helped me heal a lot. But for the past few months, I've been struggling. And I take on a lot of emotions during this podcast. And I think I've always done a good job of being able to balance that. But lately, I'm not. And so, in an effort to try and protect myself, I have made the very difficult decision to end the show. And to be clear, this is not a right now thing. This isn't the last story that you will hear from Beyond the Secret. You know, for me, I really am focused on ending this podcast right. Like, I want to feel as though I can put this perfect ending on a story that means so much to me, but I still have no clue what that looks like. So, over the next couple months, I will be working to do just that. I'm going to be bringing you updates from past guests, as well as secrets that I feel are still missing pieces of the puzzle, as well as a few of my own puzzle pieces that I have kept from you over the years that I hope will helpfully make things click for you about my struggles and ultimately why I am in the place I am today. But like I said, today is not the end. We still have a few more months together, and I think this is a good time to say, hey, if you've ever wanted to share a secret, but you kept waiting for the right time, like maybe this is that timing. You can always send your secret to beyondthesecretpodcast@gmail.com. I'm also going to be talking more about Patreon and how that will all work as the show comes to an end. But if you've ever wanted to sign up, you've only got a couple months left to do so. So there's a link in the show description if you want to do that. Okay. I've talked for long enough. And like I said, this isn't the end, because there's still so much more I need to say. But for now, I'm just going to leave this here and instead focus on tonight's story. Because tonight's secret is definitely a heavy one, but it is such an important story. And one I hope that finds its way to whoever needs to hear it. This week's secret: my husband tried to kill me and my kids. Tell me about yourself.
I am a Christian. I am a wife, a mom. I am a grandma, or a nini, as my grandchildren call me. I am a high school English teacher. I consider myself a educated person. I have a bachelor's degree and 2 master's degrees in education. And I like to think that I'm just a very kind person.
Tell me about how you first met your ex-husband, how your relationship started, what it looked like in the beginning.
I met my husband in early 1996 in a club. I was a divorced single mom of a 3.5-year-old. So I was kind of, you know, doing the weekend thing, wanting to meet people, not necessarily a person. And he kind of caught my eye, to be honest, because he was just out having fun. He wasn't that guy that, you know, that was hitting on a bunch of women or anything like that. So I kind of initiated that. So we, you know, danced that evening and exchanged numbers and didn't really hear from him for a few weeks and ran into him again. And then we really started dating casually, but more often, I guess.
As you started dating casually, what was your impression of this man?
He seemed to be educated, which is important to me because he had said he had a college degree. He had a good job. He was a few years older than I was, and he wasn't living with his parents. So that's always a good sign, especially, you know, when you have your own child, you don't want a grown child. He was pretty impressive. He was, you know, kind and actually, you know, spent some time with my son. And we just, you know, we saw each other when we saw each other, but it wasn't like a huge commitment.
Would you say that it was kind of love right away for you?
I don't know if it was love. He was definitely different than my first husband, who was physically abusive. So when I met my second husband, you know, he wasn't any of that. He didn't argue. You know, we seemed to have some things in common. So it was just very different.
As your relationship became more serious, talk to me about the dynamics of the relationship.
He seemed to be very caring. In October of that year, I unexpectedly became pregnant. And again, not having that commitment, you know, I called and he came over and I told him, and I'm a very independent person, so I didn't expect anything from him. I made that be his choice and he was all in. You know, he's anything you need, anything your son now needs, anything the baby needs, you know, you just let me know. Unfortunately, about a month later, I had a miscarriage and he was absolutely wonderful through that experience. Rushed to the hospital, took care of me. You know, it's a very emotional experience because you find out you're pregnant, you think you're going to have a baby. Even though it's unexpected, it's still exciting. And I'm a planner, so I start planning things. And then there's no baby. So he, you know, through that weekend, as I'm, you know, kind of recovering emotionally and physically, you know, he tells me, you know, that we can try again. So that is more what brought us together as a couple. He moved in just a few months, just the next month, December. and everything seemed fine. He had a good job, you know, was helping to raise my son, and things seemed to be going pretty well.
What did the people in your life, like your family, your friends, what did they think of him?
They thought he was a really great guy. Again, you know, once my family met him, my sister and I were really close, and, you know, she approved of him. So that was definitely a good thing. Once my parents got to know him, you know, he was just part of the family, you know, again, fit right in. So everybody seemed to like him and thought he was as great a guy as I did.
I want to talk a little bit about your marriage before meeting this guy and about the abuse that took place within your relationship.
I think I have to start with my upbringing. My childhood was very volatile, lots of screaming and physical fights as a child. And I knew that I didn't want a relationship like that, but didn't have the skills not to have a relationship like that. So when I met my first husband and he was so in love with me and always wanted to know where I was, I totally fell for it. But then he started to, you know, isolate me from my family. He enjoyed that a lot, that I had no one, nowhere else to go, no one to depend on. And honestly, the first time he hit me, I told him I was going to leave. Like, I'm not doing this, but I had nowhere to go. So I stayed. And then I thought, I knew better, but I thought, well, if we get married, things will get better. So we got married. They didn't get better. Oh, if we have a kid, it'll get better. We had a kid. It didn't get better. And then one time he was just screaming at me. It wasn't physical, but he was screaming at me. He backed me up against a closet door, and my child was an infant, and it made him cry. And that was the last straw. I didn't leave immediately. If you know the statistics of, you know, people trying to get out of abusive relationships, it took me several tries. But that was the moment when I was like, no, I am not raising my child like this. He is not going to witness this. He's going to grow up in a better home than I did.
After having that experience, I imagine that when you went out back into the dating world and met this guy, you were probably on pretty high alert.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I knew all the signs of I didn't know the term for it then, the love bombing, the obsessiveness, where are you, who are you with, those kinds of things. The aggressiveness before the physical part starts, you know, they just get really aggressive, like in your space, you know, their tone, you know, the way they talk to you, things like that. And saw none of that in my second husband.
How long were you together before you got married?
We were together about 2 years, 2.5 years before we got married. Once he moved in, I got pregnant almost immediately again, and we had my second, his first son, in October of 1997, and then we were married June 1998.
And throughout that 2.5 years, he was just, by all accounts, a perfect gentleman.
No, for the most part, but if something came up, he could always explain it away. So from the beginning, there were just little white lies that at the time didn't seem important.
What sort of white lies are we talking about?
He gave me a different middle name because he didn't like his middle name. He lied about where he was born. He lied about his age because, from what I've gathered, because he never admitted it, he was 2 years older than he claimed because I believe he'd been held back in school. So his age, the age that he gave, matched up with his graduation year of high school. He told me he had a college degree and he did not. But, you know, it's one lie here, everything seems fine. A little while later, another lie.
I also think it's important to remember that as we're hearing this story, that this is still the 90s. It's not as though you can quickly get on, do a Google search. It's not like he has Facebook friends that you can see and ask questions or anything like that. Like, this is it's a very different time.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, I was around his family and these things just didn't really come up. You know, I didn't know his family well enough to ask them if these things were true, once I kind of got that, you know, and I didn't know he lied about a lot of these things. So he, you know, he would tell the lie and then I'd find out later.
I'm curious to know what, if anything, did you know about his previous relationships?
I only knew of one, and the only thing I was told was that they had dated, you know, I think for a couple years in high school. And once I met my ex-husband, at that point, she had come out as a lesbian, but that's all I knew about her.
I was so waiting for you to say, because one of the red flags that I've learned is I was waiting for you to say, he said she was crazy and he was so glad to get away from her. But unfortunately, it's not the case.
No, they actually were on very good terms.
As you go into your marriage, when is the first time in which you start to see some cracks in who he is? Bigger than the white lies, but nothing that just screams out at you to run.
Right after we got married, he insisted that I start signing my name as Mrs. his first and last name. So didn't see that as this then, but totally wiping away my identity.
And yeah, it sounds very like 1950s.
Well, which is kind of, you know, it's interesting that he even had the nerve to mention that, because I had discussed not even taking his name. So it wasn't as if he didn't know how I felt about these types of things. So
how did he react when you gave some pushback against taking on his name, or saying that you didn't really want to sign your name as Mrs. his wife?
He didn't really say a whole lot when I talked about keeping my last name, because I had gone back to my maiden name after my divorce, my first divorce. That he, you know, just kind of let go. I brought it up once and he, you know, just, I could tell he didn't like it, but it wasn't a huge deal. And then same thing with the second, you know, he kind of put it out there and I was like, no, like my mother gave me a name. I have my own name and that is my name. So it just kind of fizzled out.
How was he as a now dad and also as a stepfather to your other child?
Again, at first, absolutely fabulous. Treated my son like his own. But when his son was born is when that started to change some. But I don't think it really came out until, again, after we were married. Because I think he saw that as, what's she going to do about it now? We're married kind of thing. If it wasn't as easy for me to leave if we were married. He very much expected perfection out of both of these children. Our first son together was actually a junior. So first initial J, you know, that kind of thing. So he expected perfection out of my oldest son because he wasn't his, but expected perfection out of his son because he was. So it was just portrayed very differently to each of them.
What all did you know about his childhood and his family life and like those inner workings?
Unfortunately, I didn't know a whole lot about it. He told me stories about his wonderful parents who had one fight, you know, their whole relationship, and, you know, how supportive they were of him. And I remember talking to him one time about how, you know, I feel like people always want to do better than their parents, no matter how well your parents do. You always want to do better. You know, you find different ways to do better. You know, when you know better, you do better. And I remember him making the statement one time, I don't think you can do much better than my parents. So that was just the perception he had of his childhood.
As you guys kind of find your footing with your marriage and having kids together, is there ever a point in which you can point out there was a complete shift in the person that you knew?
I don't know if there ever was a complete shift. I think he was always who he was. And I think I just so badly wanted my marriage to work and my family to stay together that I just dismissed a lot of it. I think he let his guard down as the years went on.
Speaking of that, do you, this is kind of a shitty question, but I'm going to ask it. Do you feel like there was an extra pressure on you to make this marriage work because you already had one that didn't?
Absolutely. There's also another dynamic to my relationships. I want to qualify by saying my parents and I have a wonderful relationship now, but both of my ex-husbands are a different race than I am, and my parents at the time didn't approve of that. So when I married my first husband and he ends up being physically abusive and he's a different race, and then I marry my second husband and he's a different race, yes, there were lots of reasons that I wanted this to work.
As you started to become more aware of him and who he was, what sort of things did you start to see from him that started to send off alarm bells?
He just started becoming very blatant about things. We attended a church literally two doors down from us, and he would go into church and he would testify. And I remember one time he had the whole church pray for, you know, my oldest son because he was being a kid. You know, his behavior was just whatever, and the whole church prayed for him. And we wouldn't be back at our house, and he would be cursing us all out. Like, that's how quick that switch could flip. He was a very different person in front of other people than he was at home.
A big reason why I like to share stories like yours is not just so that people might see themselves in your story and say, hey, like, I went through that same thing, but it's also, I believe these stories can serve as cautionary tales for other people. And so I'm curious, what did you tell yourself in that moment when you would see him kind of Jekyll and Hyde you? In the church, he's one way, in the car, another way. What did you tell yourself in that moment that made you, I don't want to say complacent, but made you so that you could still stay there?
I didn't think anyone would believe how he was in private because I thought he was so good at how he acted in public. I just didn't think anybody would believe me.
I'm assuming he probably did a lot of also blaming his behavior on you. Did you buy into that?
I'm sure I did sometimes. You know, if I would just not provoke, then maybe it wouldn't happen. It was definitely never his fault. It wasn't always my fault, but it was his behavior is never his fault, for sure.
And if it wasn't your fault, I'm assuming it was things like he's just stressed. He's at his wit's end. He has all these things around him that he can externally point to and say, this is why I am this way.
Yes. Yes. I wasn't treated fairly at work, or yeah, absolutely.
As you were dealing with him and his kind of erratic behavior, did you open up to anybody about what was going on?
No. No one.
And again, is that because you felt like no one would believe you?
That's part of it. Part of it is it's extremely, at least embarrassing, at most humiliating, that that's what happens at home. Like that the person that you chose, the person that's supposed to love you, treats you like that.
Can you explain that to me a little bit more? Because I've heard this before, and it's one of the things that I have the hardest time wrapping my mind around, because I think if you came to me and you told me this is what's going on at home, I would never go to trying to find a way in which this is your fault or that somehow you chose this man and now you have to live with it. I would think, God damn, like, he's a piece of shit and he was lying to you. But I've heard so many women say that exact same thing.
Well, I think you're exactly right. I don't think we would treat someone who told us that way, but when you're the person being treated that way, especially, you know, this father who goes to the kid's school and is very involved and sings in the church choir and, you know, is the fun-loving guy out in public when I'm the one who's not as social because I'm so stressed, because I don't know if I'm going to do something to piss him off. And when we get home, there's going to be this huge tirade. Again, I'm the same way. If someone came to me, I'd be like, that is horrible. You know, what can I do to help? But when I'm the one experiencing it, and there's this huge show out in public, again, I just lived in his world. I just absolutely lived in his world. And I fault no one at all, because I understand about, you know, getting involved in someone else's marriage. But no one ever said, hey, I think your husband's full of crap. he told me this wild story. Do you know what I mean? So I just thought everybody bought his story.
This is kind of a hard question to answer because you can't say for sure how you would react. But if somebody had come to you and said, hey, your husband seems like a lying piece of shit, how do you think that you genuinely would have reacted to that?
I mean, that's hard to hear from someone else, obviously. I mean, if I already know that and it's someone I trust, it might have been that segue to be like, you know, he is. And let me tell you really what he does. I think part of it too is, and again, I'm well aware of lots of statistics and that abuse happens, you know, to people of all walks of life. But I actually went back to school and have a bachelor's and a master's, and I worked on that while we were married. But, you know, I consider myself a pretty intelligent person. So it's really hard when that's something you feel is part of who you are, that you're, you know, pretty bright, that you can allow this to happen to you.
As you were married to him and as his behavior became more apparent to you, did you see changes in yourself and in your personality?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I didn't really have a lot of opinions. I mean, I did, but I didn't express them. Any TV shows we watched, they were what he liked. The music we listened to, it was what he liked. So I really did lose like a lot of myself throughout that marriage.
Was he physically abusive to you?
A few times, but never for anyone to see. I remember earlier in the marriage, we were arguing about something and he like pushed a coffee table, you know, and kind of hit me in my shins. One time he, you know, no one was ever around though. Always did it when no one, you know, especially as the kids got older. One time he walked past me and kind of shoulder bumped me and then screamed that I had hit him. Yeah, he called the police on me that time.
What did the police say when they came?
I wasn't there. I left and went to work, and they never followed up with me because I think they knew he was full of crap. I mean, he is, and I know this doesn't always mean you can't be, you know, the abuse can't go the other way, but he's about 5'10" and was always about 180 pounds. I am 5 foot on a good day, usually about 130 pounds. So, you know, if I wanted to have an altercation, it probably wouldn't be physical. That probably wouldn't end well for me. So I don't think they believed what he said.
I do find it interesting that when I asked the question, and this is just an observation, but when I asked the question, was he ever physically abusive, that your response was not yes or no. It was a few times. And the only, I think the reason I find that to be interesting is because I feel as though women, and even though obviously people know from the title of this story and we've been saying he is your ex-husband, women are still kind of conditioned to downplay things that have happened to them. And maybe because in your first marriage it was more physically abusive, this didn't feel like it was quite the same. And I just interviewed another girl who was like, well, you know, he wasn't throwing me down the stairs, so I didn't think of it as physical abuse. And it's like, physical abuse is physical abuse.
You're right. After I said that and thought about my answer, I'm like, why did I not just say yes? I think it's still, you know, as long ago as it's been, it's still hard to admit that it happened.
And I think that's such an important point to make, because you are years away from this, and it's still difficult for you to admit that what you went through was physical abuse. And imagine how difficult it is for women who are currently experiencing it to really come out and say, I am being physically abused.
Yeah, I didn't, like I said, I didn't even think about it until I said it. And then I was like, oh my, why didn't I just say yes? Yeah.
As your relationship continues on, and as red flags kind of keep popping up for you left and right, when for you did you start to come to a place where you're like, yeah, this is not good. I should probably not, like, I should, like, when did you kind of have the start of an awakening?
There were a couple times. The first time was in 2000. I consulted 2 to 3 different divorce attorneys because I didn't like what the previous one said. Our state, when it comes to custody, it's not so much like visitation, it's a percentage based on who the caretaker is previous to the divorce. So when I go to these attorneys and I'm like, he won't keep a job. He's home all the time. They tell me he will get my kids. Well, my kid, we had one at the time, because he's home. Even though he didn't do the caretaking, like, how do you prove that? I know that I gave my kids their baths every night. I know that I cooked dinner every night. I know that I made the childcare arrangements, but he lied all the time. So I was kind of defeated at that point. And, you know, I told him I wanted to divorce and I will do anything to save our marriage. So between him and what the attorneys told me, I was like, give it another shot.
And when he says that he would do anything to save your marriage, what did that look like? Obviously, it was performative, but what did that look like?
It was that honeymoon phase a while again, you know, doing family things, you know, not picking at everything. I don't know that it really lasted long. And then we just got back into the way it was, which was just normal. You know, as disruptive and chaotic as it could be, what you know is comfortable.
Do you ever remember when that would happen, when things would go back to the way that they had been before? Do you ever remember having a moment where you could identify that that's what was happening and you could say to yourself, like, things are back to the way they were, like, you, this isn't what you, like, is there an awareness like that in these situations?
For me, there really wasn't. Like, he was just so manipulative and spun things, like we talked about, you know, it was never his fault or wasn't meant that way, or, you know, it wasn't like, oh, there's something, oh, there's something else. It was just kind of like, oh boy, we're back at this again. It was more that kind of thing.
How many times did you go through this, I want to get divorced, no, baby, I'm going to make things better, and this whole cycle?
Just that once, because then in 2002, we had another child, and then in 2004, we had another child. And at the time, I had gone back to college and got my bachelor's degree, so I think part of the staying was busyness. I was just so busy. and trying to achieve goals that I just kind of lived with what was going on, because I just couldn't have any more, you know, upheaval so that I could get through getting my degree and really setting myself on a good career path.
I think this is an important question to ask, but during all of this, I think when we hear stories like this, and I always wonder if maybe we get I don't want to say a skewed version, but it is a little bit skewed because we look back at it and hindsight is 2020. But I'm, again, thinking of those people who might be in a similar situation to you right now in their lives. Were there ever happy times in all of this? Because I think sometimes people might hear these stories and they might be like, well, mine's not as bad as that. Like, we have happy times and we still celebrate and we would still do fun things together. And that helps them to explain it away. Did, in your experience, were there happy times?
I mean, yeah, our kids, you know, played sports and things. So, you know, we hung out at the ballpark with other parents and, you know, had family get togethers on holidays, you know, cookouts and Christmas and all those kinds of things. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't all awful.
And like you said, sometimes it's easier to just stay with what you know than to go out and imagine your life as, you know, a single mom. And now you have even more kids to try and care for. And I think that for a lot of women, that unknown, that life as a single mom is terrifying.
I don't think I was terrified of the single mom part of it. I mean, yes, definitely leaving your home, you know, all that new stuff, all that change. But he always threatened to take my kids. Always. I don't work. I'll tell the judge that I take care of them. I will get the kids. That kept me more than the fear of raising them by myself.
I'm curious because you said that everyone sees him as kind of this great guy. Did he present himself as though he was like a stay-at-home dad, or did he present himself as kind of an unemployed loser?
Oh, definitely. Well, neither. He was not a stay-at-home dad, and he definitely was not a loser. That is sarcasm. He was injured, so he had a surgery, and he was off of work. Well, you know, they laid them off, so now he's unemployed, so he's looking for a job. Nothing was ever his fault.
So there was always an excuse that he could tell people as to why he was home.
Yes. Or at one point it got to the point where he got up and got ready every day as if he were going to work, and he did not have a job. I didn't know that at the time.
And the people around you, people at church, your family stuff, they were all aware of the fact that he was not working?
When he pretended to go to work, you mean? Or when he was like off for other things?
Just when he was off and in general. Not when he was deceitful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They know.
See, it's interesting because I feel like I would be so curious to hear from the people who are around you. And maybe they never spoke up, but if I saw you going to school and going to work, and then I saw this man at home, and he's now, I'm all for a stay-at-home dad situation. I'm not trying to say that I'm not, but if he's not really presenting as the caretaker, he's not presenting to people as though the stay-at-home dad kind of guy, I would have thought there would be something going off in my head like, this guy's kind of a lazy piece of shit.
I found out later most people knew that. They just didn't let me know that they knew it.
Obviously, from the way we're talking, he's your ex-husband. So what led up to getting to that place where you're finally like, listen, game over, I'm done, I want out?
I think we need to start in February of 2008 when we had an accidental fire while I was at work. We were displaced from February until May from where we were living. I, at the time, was on antidepressants. I've battled depression and anxiety most of my adult life and some postpartum things. So, you know, kind of got heavy duty there. So I went the medicine route, which I'm all for if that's what you need. And that's what I needed at the time. But we have this accidental fire and we're living about 20 minutes down the road, which was just inconvenient. It was great that, you know, friends let us stay there, but it just kind of, you know, upended our lives for a little bit. I was 35 at the time and I just woke up one day, you know, and I knew he was just so full of crap and he wasn't working at the time. I'm driving an hour and a half commute every day. And I'm like, I am 35 years old and I do not want to live like this for the rest of my life. So I went to my primary care and got a referral to a therapist and started seeing him on a weekly basis, stuck with the medication and, you know, talked about my fears of, you know, I need out of this marriage. It is not good, but he's going to take my kids. And the therapist said, no judge is going to give your kids to your husband. Like, no judge is going to expect someone to give up their kids more than 50% of the time. He is not going to take them from you. And, you know, I had to think about that because that's not what I'm hearing at home. I'm hearing my kids are going to be taken away. So, you know, I really prayed about it. I, you know, continued to talk to my therapist and I'm like, you know what? That's not so bad. So, you know, so I'm planning the single mom life. You know, I have my oldest, he'll be with me all the time. He's not a consideration in the divorce. The younger three, they were involved in sports and activities. There really wouldn't be a day that I didn't see them because I'd be at the baseball field or the soccer field or at school. Even if they, you know, I didn't have them that day, I'd still be involved. I was concerned about his treatment of them, but again, proving that in court, you know, is a whole different thing. So I went to my husband and I said, I'm filing for a divorce and there's nothing you can do to change my mind. And he actually took it pretty well. I went back to therapy and I said, and I'd gotten the papers from the courthouse. I was in the process of filling them out. And I went to my therapist and I said, wow, like I told him I wanted a divorce and he actually took it well. And he said, I think this is the calm before the storm. And I just dismissed that, you know? So again, I'm saying I want a divorce. I'm done with you. I don't love you anymore. Want out of this marriage. And we're back to the love bombing. Let me make you dinner. Can I do this for you? We'd be in public and he'd try to put his arm around me or kiss me. And I would physically move away from him. Like I was making a statement that I'm done. Even though we're still married and we still live in the same house, we're done. So June 30th, we are at my son's all-star baseball game and it's raining, which is always fun. So my sister had actually just moved back to town and my niece was with us in the van. We're on the minivan, you know, have my three kids, my niece and the two of us. And I had actually borrowed $20 from my parents to pay my rent on time. And the niece is supposed to come for sleepover. And he's like, are you sure you want her to spend the night? And I was like, my sister takes our kids all the time. I mean, we have four. This is one. Why not? You know, they've lived away from us for years. Yes, I want her to spend the night. And he tried to talk me out of it. She came home with us, put the kids to bed. And I had for months been sleeping on the couch with my four-year-old. It was comforting for both of us for several different reasons, but that's just what we were doing at the time. And he insisted that I sleep in the bed that night upstairs. So I go to bed, kids go to bed, and a little before 6 a.m., I wake up to our smoke detector going off. So you're never prepared for these things. You know, you practice things in school and all that just goes out the window. So I jump up and I'm like, oh, I bet that's my oldest, because he was taking gym in summer school. He probably burnt his toast. You know, that smoke detector is really sensitive. So I jump up out of bed, I run down the stairs, and there stands my ex-husband. He has a ball cap on his head because he could never go anywhere with his hair messed up. He has a shirt on, jean shorts that are button and zipped, and sneakers that are tied. And I'm in sheer night clothes. It's summer. And I look at him, and he's just standing there very calmly. And I see smoke coming out of our basement door. And I said, where's the smoke coming from? Where's the smoke coming from? Because I can't process what's happening. And he doesn't miss a beat. I don't know, he says. So I run upstairs, wake up all the kids. Most of my boys are in their underwear. And we head outside. And he tells me he's going to try to put the fire out. I knew better. I knew better. I knew I should have called right then. But he says he's going to put it out. So we go outside. I'm not sure how long we were out there, but it hits me that we use oil to heat our home. And there's an oil tank in the basement, and my house might explode with us sitting right there. So I run back inside like, what are you doing? I can't get it out. So I pick up the phone, run outside, call the fire department. It is eerie how calm I was on that call. I listened to all kinds of podcasts, you know, true crime podcasts. Well, they didn't show any emotion. I listened to the recording of that call. I've never been more calm in my life because I had a job to do. I had to get the fire department to my house. And I talked to them just like I'm talking to you right now. I need the fire department. My house is on fire. This is my address. So the dispatcher asks if anyone's in the house, and I tell her, you know, that my husband is, and she says, tell him to get out. So I said, tell him to get out? She said, tell him to get out. So I run in, I'm still on the phone, I'm like, they're saying get out of the house, get out of the house. And he was like, okay, I can't get it out. So we all get out of the house. We're in the backyard waiting on the fire department to come. You know, the kids are scared. Windows start exploding, and that's when I just shut down. I could not figure out why my house was exploding. And they explained to me later that fire just seeks oxygen, but the noise is horrible. It's just horrendous. So we have this privacy fence in the back. So I get the kids as far out, and I'm trying to get out of the fence, and it has the board that falls down to lock it. And I can't figure out why I can't get the gate open. And I just start pounding on it. And I look down, and there's my 10-year-old just looking at me so scared, because I'm the mom and I'm supposed to take care of everything. And I can't even take care of myself. So I figure out the gate, and we go out in the alleyway, and my husband drives around with our van from the front and puts us all in it and drives us a couple blocks over to my sister's house. So we get out of the car, and I couldn't talk. I couldn't tell them what was wrong. So my sister takes my kids into her house, and my mom takes me to the hospital. And I'm sitting in the registration, and they're asking me what's wrong. And she's like, you have to tell them what's wrong. And I'm like, I just want to go to sleep. If I go to sleep and I wake up, this is going to be a dream. And this didn't happen. So, of course, they think that I'm suicidal, which I wasn't. Once I got to see my therapist, I was just in shock. I couldn't explain what was happening. Just couldn't get the words out. And but unfortunately, if you tell someone who works in the medical field you want to go to sleep, that worries them. So I was in the emergency department for about 10 hours, I think. And in the meantime, you know, they come and examine me, and they're like, we're going to have someone from the fifth floor, the psych ward, come talk to you. And they're long visitors. You know, my mom comes in to make sure I'm okay. And of course, my husband comes in to make sure I'm okay. He had had time to go to the convenience store and get himself a cup of coffee. So then the a fire investigator comes in and starts questioning me. And he said, so what do you think about this fire? I said, well, I think it looks pretty, I'm not sure what word I use, shady. We just had a fire in February and it's July 1st. And he says, would you have any reason to set this fire? And I said, I would never do anything to hurt my children. I would never set this fire. No, I did not have anything to do with this. I said, we don't even have renter's insurance. Like, we lost a few months ago and we still hadn't gotten renter's insurance. And he says, but you do have renter's insurance. I said, no. I said, yeah, here's the company. I said, you're mistaken. That's our auto insurance. He said, oh, no. Right here. 1 week ago, a policy was bought for renter's insurance. And we think your husband set this fire. But you can't say anything to him until we gather some more facts and can get him arrested. So that is when I knew I had to make a plan and get myself and my children away from him. Whatever happened with the, you know, the investigation or whatever, that was absolutely, there was no going back at that point.
As he is telling you, I think your husband is the one who set the fire, is there even a hesitation in you as to there's no way he did this? Or as soon as he said it, did you understand that that was the truth?
I knew it was the truth. I knew it was the truth because when the smoke detector woke me up and I went downstairs, he had absolutely no intentions of waking us up. None.
After you find this out and you can't tell your husband about what's happening or what they think, how do you get your kids away from him?
The only thing I could do at that point was pray and talk to my mom, because I had a 3-day visit to the psychiatric ward to get myself together, because I couldn't take care of myself. I needed someone to tell me when to eat, when to shower. I needed to be taken care of once in my life. So I did that, and I could have phone calls. I think we can make phone calls, you know, a very limited amount of time. So my mom was the one who kept in touch, and my sister was taking care of my kids. He would come visit there, you know, because we were all just smiling and nodding at him, because his family lives in the bordering state. And my sister did a very good job of keeping him from taking them across state lines. So I, you know, she really stepped in there and did that so that I didn't have to worry about them for a few days until I could get myself together and get a plan.
At what point did your husband understand that he was under investigation?
I don't think he really understood until he was arrested. I think I said before, I'm a planner. So that's what I did when I was there in the hospital for 3 days, was I made a plan. So when you're released, you have to have someone be responsible for you, come pick you up. You can't just walk out. They won't release you to yourself. So my son was still playing his baseball games, and I got a visit with them that morning. And I said, you know, go to the baseball game. So, you know, the oldest isn't late, and my mom will come get me and she'll bring me to the game. That way you don't have to worry about getting him to the game on time and running back here and waiting on me, because you might have to wait a little while. So that was the plan. He would be at the baseball field. My mom would come and get me, and we would do what we needed to do. So she picked me up. I actually walked out of the hospital in socks because we lost everything in the fire. And we went straight to the magistrate's office to get an FPO. And the magistrate looked at me and said, "You just came from the hospital, huh?" And I said, "Yes, sir." So he read my statement. He granted the FPO. They went to serve it immediately to get him away from the children. And my mom took me to Walmart to get a pair of shoes. And we go to the ball field and he is leaving. And I thought he had my kids with him. So I called him and I said, you know, tried to pretend like nothing was going on. I said, "Hey, you know, where are you going? I just passed you. We're on our way into the park." And he says, "What did you do? What are you talking about? Where are the kids with you?" "No. What did you do?" So he had been at the game and saw the police roll in. And I think he knew, maybe that's when he knew he was under suspicion and left. But he did leave my kids there. So maybe he had a hint there. But in the hospital, working with, you know, the social workers and things, they showed me the DSM for antisocial personality disorder and gave me the example of Ted Bundy, and he fit that to a T. So, you know, people with that don't think that the rules apply to them. So even if he did it, doesn't mean he should be in trouble for it. He did contact the insurance company, though, and was to get a $5,000 check. Like they give you $5,000 upfront until they investigate. And then they, you know, may pay more out depending on the policy. So once I got out of the hospital, the very next morning, I'm calling the insurance company. Put a stop order on that check. He is being investigated for arson and I will not be responsible for another debt. So of course that alerted them. I went and spoke to the detectives. It was 4th of July weekend, so things were a little delayed. That Monday, I went and talked to the detectives and told them everything I knew and learned that he had told them that I had helped him set it. I helped him set the fire. And that the reason he did it was because we were in debt. We were $60,000 in debt, which, you know, if you live in the United States, that's like two cars. And the detective says, "Do you think he was trying to kill you?" Because until then, I didn't, no one had said that. I don't know if I entertained that thought, if I'd had it. And I said, "Who wants to believe that your husband, the father of your children, would want to kill you?" I did, through therapy and some other evidence, come to the realization that yes, I do believe he was trying to kill all of us, because if my four children and I would have died in that fire, my life insurance policy would have paid out $460,000. So he would have gotten $400,000 after paying off this debt he was so worried about.
When the detective asked you, "Do you think he was trying to kill you?" what sort of emotions came over you?
I think I was just bewildered. I really felt like I was in a Lifetime movie. Like it was just surreal to hear that out loud.
I knew what was coming because I knew the story that was presenting itself. And I got goosebumps when he asked you about your niece staying over.
Yeah, absolutely premeditated.
I think people listening at the time, as you were saying, it might have been like, this is a stupid fact. Like, we don't care about your niece. Like, what's happening? But it's like, no, that was insanely important to this story.
Absolutely.
going back to when you're coming down the stairs and you see him there and he's fully dressed, he's acting like he's cool. Can you go back to that? And do you see anything that stands out to you about him standing there?
Like I said, he was fully dressed. He was very, you know, meticulous about how his hair looked. So to have, you know, that baseball hat on his head and his sneakers tied, and, you know, I have on a, you know, sheer little pajama set because it's summertime, and he doesn't make a move. He doesn't bound up the stairs to wake us up. He actually, when he was, you know, claiming to be putting out the fire, he actually set a second fire on the main floor. And I believe it was very targeted, is the only word I can think of. He set the fires in plastic totes in the basement that had my kids' schoolwork, trophies, all those things that can't be replaced. And I don't want to sound ungrateful, because I know that God saved us that day, because that was not our time to go. But once you get through all the shock and you start putting your life back together and you're like, I know there was this baby picture. Oh, that's right. I don't have that anymore. Yeah, just seemed a little more, if you could get any more personal or more hateful, I'm not sure how.
When you mention the fence in the backyard, did you always struggle with that fence?
We really didn't ever go out of that fence. So it wasn't like we went out of it every day and I just forgot how it latched, how it locked.
Remind me again of the time frame between when you said you wanted a divorce and when the fire occurred.
I think I told him in June, so less than a month. I did find out later that July 1st, he was due in court in a neighboring county on credit card fraud from the job he had been fired from, the one that he pretended to still go to.
So they arrest him for setting this fire, but I'm curious because it seems really hard to prove, because you guys got out of the house, that he was intentionally setting this fire to try and kill you guys, but instead maybe just trying to do some insurance fraud.
Well, he wasn't charged with attempted murder. You know, they did ask me the question, and then again, I just couldn't process that. But once my sister and my cousin went and salvaged a few, not very many, a few things, and one of those was my insurance policy. And that's when putting, you know, how much he would have profited off not just the renter's insurance, but the life insurance policy, and the fact that he was not making a move to wake us up as the smoke detector was going off. That's when I came to the realization that he would absolutely have been fine if we did not get out that morning. He was charged with first degree arson. He also had been embezzling from our church because he was the treasurer. So he would take all the checks and deposit them and keep all the cash from people's offerings. And he was charged with 5 felony counts of child neglect.
This is kind of a random side question, but I'm curious what happens to you in the situation where your house has been burned down, but it's by the person you're married to. Like, are you just shit out of luck when it comes to the financial aspect of that?
We were actually renting at the time. So I'm not sure what would have happened if we owned it.
So did your insurance still cover, though, even though he intentionally said it?
Actually, they did. The renter's insurance, they did. I had to make an itemized list of what belonged to us as a couple, what belonged to me, and then what belonged to the children. So if I remember right, they paid for what belonged to me and the children. And I think it was 50% if it belonged to both of us, like the TV belonged to both of us. So they gave me 50% of what they would have paid if it were mine.
Technically, nothing was his, though, because he just sat around on his ass on the couch.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's I would absolutely agree with that.
I mean, not to be a shitty person, but I would have been like, 100% it's all mine.
Yeah.
I let him enjoy it on occasion.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. Guess maybe I'm too honest. I did not want to, you know, I was grateful they were paying anything. So I don't know that they would have bought, you know, that we were married and everything belonged to me. So I tried to be very honest about it.
Once he is arrested and convicted of these crimes, how do you begin to process everything? And also, I'm assuming because of the child neglect, there's no having to like bring the kids to jail to see their dad or anything, is there?
No, absolutely not. He actually pled guilty, which was a miracle in itself. But in my divorce, because the divorce was final before he actually pled guilty, the judge gave me all physical, legal custody, all decision-making rights, because he didn't show up for the divorce. I think he was scared to set foot in the courthouse until his trial. But then when he pled guilty and he went for sentencing, the judge recommended that his rights be terminated. Unfortunately, in our state, CPS or DHHR will not step in if he's in prison because there's no imminent danger. Part of his sentence, though, was that once he is paroled, he is to be on a child abuse registry, I think, for 10 years.
I just keep thinking about the fire that you experienced in February and what happened there?
That was when I was commuting. So I was on my way home and he called and he was very dramatic. And he's like, I need to tell you something. And I can hear he's talking to someone. I was like, should I tell her now? And he's like, we had a house fire. So, the story he told was that he must have left the iron plugged in, which irons then, you know, had the auto off. But when I looked at the house, it was in our bedroom and the mattress looked like someone had taken a bite out of it where it was burned. So that was actually ruled accidental by the fire investigator, I guess, because there wasn't an accelerant. Like he used an accelerant in the July fire. There was no accelerant. What I think he did was turn the iron on and laid it on the bed because the wall wasn't burned, like where the ironing board would be. So I think he did it like as a trial run to kind of see how it worked and to see if he could get away with it.
And once you had your second fire, did they ever go back to that original one and say, hey, we should probably look at this again?
No.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So he goes to jail and you live your life. And it's like we want to be at this point now where it's like, oh, here it comes. That fairy tale ending. And
yes.
For a while, you had kind of your fairy tale ending.
Yes, I am remarried. Third time's a charm, I guess. he's been around a good long time and loves my boys. And, you know, I have four wonderful children who have grown up and are happy and healthy. And two of them have started their own families. Like I said, I have three grandchildren. I have my dream job. I know that's kind of corny, though, as an English teacher, but I love where I work and, you know, the people I work with and what I do. You know, we have a nice home and a nice life. And, Yeah, it would be great if that's where the story ended, wouldn't it?
But recently there has been a new curveball thrown your way. And what was that?
He was granted parole on March 22nd was the hearing, and he will be released no earlier than April 21st, which is very frustrating. This is the fifth parole board hearing that I have attended because he was sentenced. He got 15 years for the arson. The embezzlement was concurrent with that. And then his five child neglect charges are 1 to 5 years. Well, those are my babies, even my niece. They were babies, 14, 10, 6, and then two of them were 4 years old at the time. So they were babies. So 5 times 5 for those is 25 plus 15 is 40 years. Good. You should serve 40 years. I understand that doesn't happen. But at the first parole hearing, the parole board, there are three people. One of them was on their cell phone. One of them was stirring their coffee. And I just didn't feel like I mattered much. And he was denied parole that year because he'd had some infractions. But the victim's advocate came to me and she said, the parole board feels like maybe you're confused about the amount of his sentences. And I laid it out for her. That's 40 years. She said, oh, in our state, you get credit for a day for every day that you serve. So if someone gets a 40-year sentence, they will never serve more than 20. You get credit a day. So you get a 2-for-1.
That is the best 2-for-1 anyone could get. Why? Then why don't we say that it's 80 years?
Right.
And then you serve 40.
Great idea.
So he is currently using his Disney Fast Pass. And
yes.
He's going to be essentially a free man.
Yes. In just a few weeks here. And the other four hearings, I feel like they only denied it because he had infractions in prison. So this year, I always speak, and I always speak so that he can hear me because I want him to hear me say what terrible things he's done. And this year, a couple of years ago, they denied it because he had those infractions. And I bring up the point, if he can't follow the rules in prison, how do you expect him to follow the rules outside of prison? I think it was 2020, one of the parole board members, when they came out to let us know they decided to deny it, he actually told me that 11 years is a pretty long sentence. And I said, all due respect, my children and I have served a very long sentence.
I think the hard thing here is that they might just be looking at this as though like, hey, the guy set a fire or whatever. But it's like, no. He was attempting to murder you and your children and your niece. Like, while that wasn't proven, while that wasn't the route that they took to try and stick to him, that is the truth. Like, he asked, are you sure you want your niece to be here? Like, it's more than that. This man is extremely dangerous.
Yes. Yes, he is. And I told them, you know, I believe that people go to prison and are reformed. And I believe that people go to prison and stew. I have seen him do spiteful things. And although he wouldn't get any money, maybe he just wants the satisfaction of saying he did it. How do I know he's not going to find out where I live? Set my house on fire when I'm asleep. Or find out where my children have bought houses.
Do you know what his infractions in prison were? Do they tell you that?
They ask him about it is how we find out. So the first year he had smuggled cigarettes in, which my oldest and I were... He had gone with me that time and we looked at each other and we were like, but he doesn't smoke. And the victim's advocate's like, they weren't for him. So I'm inferring that he was smuggling cigarettes in for sexual favors and got caught. One time he had CDs he wasn't supposed to have. They always ask him, and you know, it's never his fault. He just forgot to give those CDs back. Last year he was caught with drugs, but it wasn't like Suboxone, like something like that, I think. But you know, that wasn't true. He had been sick. He just like had the flu or something, which I mean, I'm pretty sure the flu doesn't make you test positive for Suboxone, but it's just always something. It's just never, still never his fault.
Since he's gone to prison, or since he was arrested, have the two of you ever had a conversation again?
No.
Are you worried about him? I mean, I think extreme case, you're worried about him finding you and doing something to you. And what people have to remember about that is, you might think a lot of time has passed here, and but for a lot of these people, when they go into prison, they leave the next day of like when they went in there. Like everything is still, so he's still mad at you. He's right. Still upset with you. He's not going to come out and be like, oh, wow, all that time has passed and life is good. It's like, no, I still have a vendetta to get to.
Right. That is my concern. He's a coward. So I don't think he'd ever approach like in public where there are witnesses. Like that's just not who he is. But, you know, find some gasoline and, you know, find out where I live. Who knows?
How does your current husband feel about everything that's happening?
He is very supportive of me and how I feel, but he deals with things very differently than I do. So just like with my childhood and my first marriage, like talking really helps me, like sharing my story, you know, helps me. It doesn't help him. He puts it in the past and leaves it there. So while he supports me and how I feel about this, he doesn't really have an attachment to the situation. If that, I don't want him to sound cold because he's not. That's just how he deals with things.
And how do your children feel about him getting out of prison?
None of them are happy about it. My oldest one detests him. You know, he was almost 15 when it happened and remembers a lot of the abuse and the trauma. My second oldest has gone so far as to change his entire name to not be a junior and not be associated with him. I think he might be more worried than he tells me. The third one is in college right now, and he's just, you know, that happy-go-lucky kid, like not going to let it bother him because he's got his own life to live, which is good. My youngest I really worry about. He's terrified. He is, you know, looking at colleges and thinking of where he could get a job to make sure that my ex-husband won't know where he is, or that he might not run into him, you know, so that he can't run into him, which is, you know, a whole nother devastation to me, because no matter how grown they are, and, you know, obviously they're all bigger than I am at this point. It's devastating knowing as their mom, I can't protect them or even make them feel safe about the situation when that's my job. So.
Here's the thing. This man is going to come out into the world, and he has stolen a lot from you. And I think I agree with you. I think that people go into church or I think that people go into jail and they can absolutely come out reformed. And maybe that is his story. Maybe that's a story that can come out. But there's also the possibility that he's going to come out. And while he may not try to kill you, it doesn't mean that he's not going to still come out and try to suck the life out of you.
Right.
Do you have still an order of protection against him? Does that wear off after his parole? Like, how does that all work?
I think once he went to prison, that was, you know, negated. He is ordered by the parole board. I want to get this right. He is ordered by the parole board to have no contact with any of us. But there's no protection of order, or order of protection, sorry. And having had several of those throughout my life, I believe in order to actually go get a new paper, you know, like from the county, like from where I live, I would have to show that he has threatened me or abused me or something now. So he is ordered by the parole board not to have any contact. His home plan, he had to submit a home plan. It's to go live with his parents, like I said, which is in the neighboring state, but it's also the neighboring county. We live in a really unique place where we border two states that closely. And he was, you know, strongly recommended by one of the parole boards that he not ever come back to our state. Whether they can enforce that or really do anything about it just because he's in the state or even in our county, I'm not sure.
So here's how I want to end this interview, is not talking about this piece of shit ex-husband of yours, but instead talking about you. And even though you're at this place, and even though this might be, just as your therapist said before, the calm before the storm, I don't want to take away from the fact that you have come such a long way and your life is so much happier and you have a lot to show for that. I would love if you would just talk to the audience about where you're at now, and even if the future is unknown right now, at least we can know, like, this is where you've gotten to.
I am at the most peaceful I've ever been in my life. Like I said, there was a lot of chaos and that was just normal, but my life is really peaceful. I love my job. You know, I love where I work. I have wonderful, supportive friends. I have a wonderful, you know, group of women that I'm close with that we prop each other up, which is wonderful. I have, you know, wonderful relationships with all of my children, you know, where we spend lots of time together, which I think says a lot about, you know, what happened to us and again, how far we've come. I really, in this whole experience, have found my voice. I, for so long, had someone telling me what I like or what I don't like. And I had to find those things out for myself at 35. And I still, you know, work on that, like speaking up for myself and things like that. But it's much more natural now for me to stand up for who I am and what I believe in and be okay if someone doesn't like that part of me, or even me as a person, that's okay. My students, you know, are shocked to find out that, you know, I, even as a child, I was painfully shy. And I'm not that person. You know, I'm very social. I love to be around, I don't think positive is the right word, but just uplifting people, you know, people who are kind and people who want to support other people and see other people do well. And that's really who I try to be, you know, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. If you're working towards what you want to be, who you want to be, good for you, you know, whatever it is. If that's what you like and that's what you want to work on and you're working on it, that's wonderful. That's where I am. You know, I spend more time doing things I enjoy and not so much time doing things I don't enjoy, or, you know, being around the people I want to be around and not being around people that aren't those people, aren't those uplifting people. So I'm very happy with where I am. As horrible as this event was, and, you know, the years of my life I spent being treated that way, I learned a lot. And that's how I can be okay with it, is I learned a lot. I learned that, you know, I don't deserve to be treated like that. And no one does, for any reason. And I learned that, you know, I do have that voice, and I can speak up and out, not just for myself, which I think is usually the first step, but for others who maybe not, may not have found their voice yet.
If you or someone you know is a victim of domestic violence, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline or visit them online at thehotline.org. Or you can send START to 88788 to get more information. I really hope that if any part of this woman's story feels like something you're going through or something that someone you know is going through, let this be your warning. Thank you so much for being here and listening. I will see all of you next month.
Everybody has a secret.